Hello again and welcome to the Culture File Weekly with me, Luke Clancy. And the very meaning of fear itself is our matter. And Daryl Jones, TCD Professor of English and Dean of Humanities, is our guest. Although given Professor Jones specialises in thinking, talking and writing about horror, it might be more accurate to call him the Dean of Inhumanities. I've already asked him if he'd mind Horrordemic, and he did. Jones's latest book, Sleeping with the Lights On, attempts to bring some of the huge amounts of academic attention that's been paid to horror in recent years to a broader audience, to everyone who's ever wondered about the why of vampires and zombies, but generally enjoys their chills in the company of a large popcorn rather than an essay by Julia Kristeva. Jones's own dark fascination began long before he first wondered about Dracula and colonial anxiety or how a Marxist might see the undead. It all started in Woolworths.
The rats. I walked into Woolworths in Pontypridd in South Wales in, I'm guessing, 1979. I was about 12 years old. And bought a copy of James Herbert's The Rats. It had this extraordinarily lurid cover. There was this huge rat with gigantic yellow-brown incisors. I devoured it, the rats, in an afternoon in my grandmother's house. I was very conscious that this may have been the first real grown-up novel that I had read. So this was one of my first, if not my actual first, encounter with the adult world, adult literature. I felt that, okay, I've crossed some kind of Rubicon here. You know, this morning I was a boy, now I am a man, and James Herbert is somehow responsible for having done this. Horror has always been with us in various different ways. We may not always have called it that, but the tropes, the themes, the images, the preoccupations of horror are very, very ancient ones, be they bodily dismemberment and the vulnerability and weakness of the human body, or questions about the afterlife and what happens, if anything, to your soul, if there is one, after death. Serious issues about your place in the universe, about the relationship between body and spirit. One of the most, I suppose, celebrated and widely quoted definitions of horror comes from the great American early 20th century writer H.P. Lovecraft in his work Supernatural Horror in Literature, that talks about the oldest and deepest fear of humanity being fear of the unknown, and that all horror stems from that and plays on that. And that's not without truth. That's not without a basis in truth. But I think the reality is often much more complex and much more nuanced than that. That forms of horror change with their times. I'm 50 years old, and so I did my growing up, my adolescence and young adulthood, at least across the 1980s. And the great fear for my generation was the fear of nuclear holocaust. You know, the dread of the mushroom cloud appearing on the horizon. The anxiety with nuclear holocaust was not a fear of the unknown. It was that we knew exactly what it is that we had to be afraid of. And these documentaries and films showing the aftermath of nuclear attacks often showed us in graphic detail what it was that we had to expect, you know, from nuclear winter to radiation sickness to resource scarcity, all of these things. But this is a very new and very contemporary horror. It's an inconceivable horror to anybody born before the second half of the 20th century, I guess. But it's also generational. So my daughter, who is now 23, her generation don't, as far as I'm aware, lie awake at night dreading nuclear holocaust. Although the bombs haven't gone away, we can still blow the world up many times over. But the location of horror has shifted. And for very understandable reasons now, a prevalent cultural anxiety, perhaps the prevalent cultural anxiety, is ecological catastrophe. The Intergovernmental Report on Climate Change that just came out a couple of weeks ago makes for literally terrifying reading, you know, that we have perhaps not even decades, perhaps only a few years to save the world. And if not, we're looking into a future of, you know, blistering summers, of the death of coral, of human migration on a scale that we've never seen before, possibly the total breakdown of human social organization. This is absolutely terrifying. So we have seen, and surprisingly, I think, across the course of the 21st century, a wave of ecological, eco-horrors, climate change horrors, often to do with the melting of the polar ice caps, for example, or at least set in the polar regions in films like 30 Days of Night, for example, or TV series like Fortitude. There's a lot of them. The last decade of the 19th century really is the symbolic high point of, well, certainly of British imperial expansion. And one of the things that I concentrate on is the year 1897 as a symbolic zenith of the British Empire. It's the year of the Diamond Jubilee of Queen Victoria, 60 years of Queen Victoria's reign. But it's also the year of the publication of a number of landmark works of horror. It's the year that Bram Stoker's Dracula is first published. It's the year that Richard Marsh's The Beetle is first published. It's the year that H.G. Wells's War of the Worlds is first published, at least in serial form. It comes out in book form the following year. And I think this is no accident. And these three works are just three in a much larger body of, I guess you'd call them, works of colonial or of imperial horror that look at the anxieties and vulnerabilities of the British Empire. So London gets invaded innumerable times during the popular fiction of this period, in theory by Count Dracula and his vampire minions, by invading Martians, by yellow peril Chinese like Fu Manchu, for example, by mummies and undead Egyptians, by actual fictional German invaders and the like. So that you know, there is this sense at the very zenith of the British Empire that it's aware of its own vulnerabilities, its own sense that it is porous, that London, particularly as the centre of the world, is we don't know who's coming in to London. So in some ways, these are very contemporary anxieties, but it's testimony to the way, I think, in which horror particularly, but popular fiction and popular genres more generally, cast a light on or hold up an often distorted mirror to the times that produce them. They're a way of thinking through the times we live in. There's a very famous book by the critic Nina Auerbach called Our Vampires Ourselves. And she makes the point that we reinvent vampires. Each subsequent generation reinvents vampires in its own image. And, you know, I like to think that there's a reason that vampires famously don't cast any reflection in a mirror. It's because what's looking back at us is ourselves, or at least a distorted version of ourselves. And I have to say, since the 1970s, since the publication of Anne Rice's Interview with the Vampire in 75, 76, we've had a different kind of, an almost aspirational kind of vampire. Reading Bram Stoker's original novel, for example, the Count exercises an enormous presence in the first part of the novel, Jonathan Harker's diary, but effectively disappears from the novel after that. He's a threat to be encountered, to be destroyed, and we're with the vampire hunters. You know, Dracula sometimes makes almost cameo appearances in his own novel after that, and there's very much the sense that he's a kind of radically other threat, that he's out there, that he's coming to get us, that we have to protect ourselves from him, that we don't understand him. After Anne Rice, vampires become humanized, they become psychologized, they become romanticized, although they were always, to a certain extent, romantic figures. They begin to have rich inner lives of various kinds until we end up with Twilight, which is more or less where we are today, which is the vampire as a kind of idealized expression of a kind of teenage, romantic teenage outsiderliness, I guess. This is often a way in which I think popular culture more generally works, is that it offers sometimes displaced images, symbols, or figures that help us to think through contemporary situations and anxieties. London was not in any serious danger of being invaded by vampires in 1897 or by mummies, but these figures, you know, body forth a whole set of anxieties about what lay beyond the bounds of the margins of, you know, what a writer like Kipling, I suppose, would have thought of as the civilizing moral mission of the British Empire, or a writer like Arthur Conan Doyle would have thought of in the same way. This came with often terrible costs and anxieties, anxieties which were to spill out in the early and mid-20th century into colonial wars and decolonization. So the British Empire could not hold, and these kinds of anxieties are very visible in the fiction of the time. You also see very famously the sense of producing images or symbols or figures for your anxieties in a certain kind of post-war horror. If you're a resident of Tokyo in the late 1940s and early 1950s, the reality of the bomb is probably far too close to look in the eye. You know, it's a real living reality. And so here comes Godzilla, this gigantic, irradiated, fire-breathing dragon monster that lays waste to Japanese cities. It doesn't require an advanced degree in literary criticism to work out what's going on there.
You're listening to the Culture File Weekly Sauron Special, where our passerby in from the frosty night is Professor Daryl Jones. Jones is a kind of literary vampire hunter, and indeed a pursuer of zombies, through their earliest film incarnations to their postmodern revival, as we'll discover in a moment, should we survive. Once upon a time, zombies, werewolves, vampires, these weren't quite seemly passions in the English department. But, well, things change, and the shelves have filled, magically, with books decoding the undead and their kin. Which isn't to say that your average Pontypridd-born horror superfan doesn't occasionally find themselves treated with disdain.
Those of us who are in our various ways interested in horror often find ourselves in the position of having to defend our interests, that there is something wrong or dangerous or sick about an interest in these kinds of things. There are people out there who simply don't understand or don't want to experience horror. One of the things that people don't understand is that it is an extremely pleasurable genre. Horror audiences very often find themselves not just screaming, but also laughing, and sometimes laughing and screaming at the same time. I went to see the remake of Halloween just last weekend with an audience who were laughing, and sometimes it was a sort of nervous giggle of a laugh, and sometimes it was more than that, but who were laughing as much as they were screaming or gasping. And never underestimate the pleasures of genre, which are the pleasures of the repetition of an experience. I liken it sometimes to ritual, you know, the religious rituals. We are participating or celebrants in a religious ritual, acting out preordained roles and parts.
Ring around the roses, pocket full of posies.
Mary Douglas was an anthropologist, a structural anthropologist, and her most famous book is called Purity and Danger, written in the 1960s, and itself very influential on Julia Kristeva's Powers of Horror, which is a further theoretical elaboration of Douglas's structural anthropological ideas that the mind works through dualities, binaries, and dichotomies, very clear category distinctions. And it's where those clear distinctions are violated, in the gaps between them, in the interstices, to use Douglas's own word, between them, that uncertainty and anxiety arises. You know, if we don't know whether we're dealing with something which is alive or dead.
Alive or dead.
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 Alive or dead. Those two very, very clear category distinctions.
Alive or dead.
If we don't know that, if we can't tell the difference between inside and outside, you know, what's safely kept inside our own body, what's outside, and so consequently self and other, these are the moments where abjection arises. There are substances that, as long as they're kept safely within the boundaries of our own body, blood is famously one, but there are others, spit, mucus, goo, guts of various kinds. If they're kept in their place, that's fine. But once they spill out, once they permeate beyond the boundaries of our own bodies, they become abject, they become the sites of anxiety, of fear. It's amazing how often horror films play on these and break down these distinctions. The first thing to say about zombies is that whenever they appear, and historically this is certainly the case, they always signify economic exploitation of some kind or another. You know, going back to the roots of zombie in voodoo, that, you know, a sorcerer raises the dead to do their bidding, but they are then deeply implicated in Caribbean slavery, for example. So a whole economy of exploitative, violently exploitative, economic human relations. And so zombie culture has always signified that. Even in early zombie films like Victor Halperin's White Zombie from the 1930s, with Bela Lugosi, you know, raising the dead to work his Caribbean sugar plantations. So, you know, it's very clearly the case there that what you've got is a kind of economically disenfranchised lumpen proletariat, if you want to put it in Marxist terms. It's no accident then that when a filmmaker like George Romero makes Night of the Living Dead in 1968, first of all, you know, this is very clearly a film about the toxic social condition of America in 1968, and America mired in an unwinnable and unpopular war in Vietnam. 1968 is the year of the assassination of Martin Luther King, of Robert Kennedy, you know, coming quickly on the heels of the assassinations of John F. Kennedy, of Malcolm X and others. This is a film in which very many of those tensions come out, and come out even more strongly, I think, in the follow-up, Dawn of the Dead, which is the seminal zombie film, and I think, you know, one of the great economic satires ever conceived, in which very famously both the zombies and the surviving humans head for a gigantic shopping mall, because that's where they feel happiest, that's where they feel most at home. The sense of consumer capitalism producing the undead, who simply who don't know what they're doing, but who cannot help themselves but be drawn towards shopping malls, is an extraordinarily powerful and resonant image. And then I think it's no accident that certainly in the last decade or so, we're living through an intense interest in zombie culture since the global financial crisis. And I think there are many people out there who feel as though, you know, they have no control over their own lives. They are enthralled to forces beyond their understanding. They have no agency. They do feel like a sort of mindless, undifferentiated mass. And the zombie is the perfect embodiment of these kinds of anxieties.
Yet a television series, the incredibly popular television series The Walking Dead, the critique is kind of very watered down in the contemporary version of the zombie movie, which is The Walking Dead.
That's right. And, one of the things I would say is that you're not going to get a long-running, highly successful TV series which goes on for season after season, mounting a withering criticism of the thing which sustains it in the first place. And this I think leads us to the sort of mainstream corporatization of horror. Simply be my own age and generation, the fact that I did grow up watching 1970s into 80s independent, generally American, sort of semi-art house horror movies that were made cheaply, exploitatively, unquestionably exploitatively, by sort of deranged sort of garage auteurs on a shoestring. One of the things that's often said about the great John Carpenter, for example, is that his career took a nosedive as soon as he started to get budget. You know, as soon as he became implicated within a studio system, respectability can often be very, very damaging for horror. It often works best as a sort of edgy, sort of anti-establishment, kind of radical, kind of avant-garde, obnoxious, rebarbative, unpleasant, disreputable art form. Quiet, bang. When that's all that you have is what the critic Mark Kermode calls the quiet, bang, horror is no longer asking these kinds of serious questions, questions about the body, about your place in the universe, you know, about economic exploitation. It's merely trying to make you jump. I came up with this term, unhorror, which is an ugly, unsatisfying term for an ugly, unsatisfying cultural form, to describe this sort of toothless, incorporated horror, which has no possibility of horrifying, because, you know, it has very little possibility of offending anybody. That's certainly the case with mainstream American cinematic horror. I see alternatives. I see other places for horror to flourish.
Where is my daughter? People don't just disappear.
The Slender Man is fascinating and I think genuinely terrifying, in fact. And one of the ways that it is genuinely terrifying is not just its transmedial sense, but the sense that it is consistently evolving, it's decentered, so there's no one controlling voice here, which means that it's potentially at least everywhere at the same time. And there's no narrative to it either. You know, there is a vaguely definable sense of menace. The Slender Man owes its origins to a couple of photoshopped images that were posted a decade or so ago on actually a sort of comic chat group discussion website. Images of children, but with very grainy, photoshopped, indistinct figures in the background of both of these images of tall, slender men wearing dark suits with what appeared to be multiple arms or tentacles for arms, perhaps, and with some sort of overarching narrative of the violent or mysterious deaths of children.
You say photoshopped, of course. We don't know that they're photoshopped.
No, we don't. Of course we don't. Tragically, there have been cases. There was a very high-profile case in Wisconsin of a pair of young girls who, after a night of reading online Slenderman creepypasta narratives, that's the word, user-generated online narrative fiction of various kinds, in this context, certainly generally of a sort of scary variety, and that after a night of reading online creepypasta, a pair of young girls attacked and stabbed and almost killed one of their classmates because the Slender Man told them to do it. They wanted to be the Slender Man's servants, his proxies was the word that they used. And just last year, the case went to trial and they were both sentenced to very long sentences in mental institutions. It is a very disturbing story, but it's the latest of a series of these kinds of moral panics about horror. It's the James Bulger case of the 1990s. It's the video nasties of the 1980s. It's the publication of The Monk in the 1790s. These are works which will tend to deprave and corrupt, and that watching or experiencing horror, violent or brutal acts, will tend to make you go out and perform those acts. The reality is much, much more complex than that.
You've been listening to the Culture File Weekly Sawan Special with our guest Daryl Jones. Daryl Jones' latest book is Sleeping with the Lights On, The Unsettling History of Horror, and it's out now from Oxford University Press. We'll be back with more undead metaphors next Friday at 7 p.m. Until then, bye now.